Good morning, my friends. Welcome back. I'm going to start pretty close to straight up 10, because just between you and me, I don't want it to get out of this room, just a little secret. My wife chewed me out this past week. Now, don't tell her I mentioned it, because, you know. She said I went long last week, too much, and so I decided I better get started a little bit quicker and be a little bit more mindful of the time. So I'm going to, that's my contract with you. So it is now about 2 minutes after 10, and church starts. I know many of you go to the second service, and church starts at 11:15, so my deal is we'll be done at straight up 11. All right, so that'll give you a chance to lead. You don't have to do a 100-yard dash sliding into the pew in church, as I think some of you felt like you had to do last week. So I apologize for keeping you a little bit too leisurely in our presentation. And that means I'm going to try to be done with my talking by about 10 till. So that'll leave us around 10 minutes or so for additional conversation that you may want to raise at that point. So that's the deal. I got my clock here, and my wife is going to shoot spit wads at me if I forget, so there we are. Anyway, we are this morning coming in our continuing discussion of the historical context of the Bible to the second great kind of epic event that is recorded for us in the first few chapters of Genesis, which is the flood. Takes up about four chapters, actually. Chapters 6, 7, 8, and 9 of Genesis, of course, are that extended discussion of a huge deluge that we all learned about way back in Sunday school when we saw the little flannograph and boats, you know, with animals in it, and there's Noah and his family and so on, and the story of the flood, which, of course, has been a very important part of the whole understanding of the ancient Old Testament history, but for many, many years, there was a kind of at least question as to whether any such deluge ever existed, and a further question whether or not any other ancient civilization had any memory of it. But that all changed rather dramatically in the middle of the 1800s when this remarkable document was discovered, which is called the Epic of Gilgamesh. And so that's what we're looking at this morning. Last week we looked at Enuma Elish and the creation account, and we were noting there that at least it seems on the face of it that the assumption behind the scenes is that that cosmology of the ancient Sumerian and Mesopotamian outlook is assumed, but it is subjected to a great critique. So rather than having gods at war with each other and all sorts of strange kinds of happenings, bizarre interactions of these alleged deities, you've got a wonderfully dignified presentation of a God who is in perfect control, simply speaking things into being, and those things take place. And there's no contest, there's no question about the outcome. And I think we see something of the same thing going on here in connection with the way in which we contrast the flood account that we find in the Gilgamesh epic from that which we find in the biblical account. So anyway, I'll let that kind of settle there with you for a few moments. But let's take our Bibles and turn to Genesis. Obviously, we can't read all four chapters. That would take about all the time we have. So I just want to pick a couple of representative texts. You're familiar with this story of Noah and the flood, but I want to highlight a couple of little paragraphs in it, and that'll set the stage for our comments this morning. So first of all, we're in Genesis chapter 6, and we'll start at verse 5 and just read that short paragraph, which is the beginning now of the flood account, the story of Noah. Genesis chapter 6, verse 5, the Word of God. The Lord saw that the wickedness of humankind was great in the earth, and that every inclination of the thoughts of their hearts was only evil continually. And the Lord was sorry that he had made humankind on the earth, and it grieved him to his heart. So the Lord said, I will blot out from the earth the human beings I have created, people together with animals and creeping things and birds of the air, for I'm sorry that I've made them. But Noah found favor in the sight of the Lord. So there's our initial text, and then if you're familiar with how the story unfolds, you know that in the rest of chapter 6, we have this description of how God gives Noah warning that a flood is coming, gives him instruction as to how to construct this, what's called an ark, a rather unusual word, not a boat, not a barge, but an ark, a word that has a somewhat distinct sense to it. In chapter 7, we have a description of the flood actually taking place, this great deluge of water, both coming from the sky and also somehow the deep is opened up and some sort of wells or springs come out of the earth, and there's this huge flood. In chapter 8, we begin to hear about how the flood subsides after a good long time. And then at verse 6 of chapter 8, we have the following. At the end of 40 days, Noah opened the window of the ark that he had made and sent out the raven. And it went to and fro until the waters were dried up from the earth. Then he sent out the dove from him to see if the waters had subsided from the face of the ground. But the dove found no place to set its foot, and it returned to him to the ark, for the waters were still on the face of the whole earth. So he put out his hand and took it and brought it into the ark with him. He waited another 7 days, and again he sent out the dove from the ark. And the dove came back to him in the evening, and there was in its beak a freshly plucked olive leaf. So Noah knew that the waters had subsided from the earth. Then he waited another 7 days, and he sent out the dove, and it did not return to him anymore. Then you have an ongoing account of the ark being opened, the family coming out, and then we have the concluding remark here in chapter 8 that continues into chapter 9, which has to do with the Noahic covenant, as it's called, and we'll just read the last part of chapter 8. Then Noah built an altar to the Lord and took of every clean animal and every clean bird and offered burnt offerings on the altar. And when the Lord smelled the pleasing odor, the Lord said in his heart, I will never again curse the ground because of humankind. For the inclination of the human heart is evil from youth, nor will I ever again destroy every living creature as I have done. As long as the earth endures, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night shall not cease. So there we have little representative snippets from the story of Noah and the flood. Let's ask God's blessing on our discussion this morning. Great God in heaven, we are deeply grateful to you for the opportunity once again to reflect on the way in which you have worked in history, and especially how we see evidence of that even in sources outside the biblical account. We pray that you would give us discriminating and discerning eyes, ears, and hearts as we reflect on these matters, that all of it would lead us to a deeper and more profound adoration and love of our Lord Jesus Christ, in whose name we pray. Amen. As I was mentioning a moment ago, it was rather common, especially in critical circles down through history, really going clear back to the Renaissance and thereafter, to wonder if the entire story of the flood and Noah was just simply some kind of great legend intended in a sort of parabolic way to teach us great truths, but that we were not supposed to take seriously that any such catastrophe had ever occurred. And that all changed, at least to some degree, in the mid-1800s with the discovery of this great epic story that has come down to us, and it's called by the term the Epic of Gilgamesh, which is readily available. You can run right down after Sunday school and pick up your own copy. Not autographed in this case by Gilgamesh, I'm sure, but it's readily available at Auntie's Bookstore, Barnes & Noble, and I'm not being paid to say any of that, but it's kind of a fun read. It's a rollicking adventure, and certainly for whatever else it may serve in your life, it'll simply be kind of an interesting little excursion into an ancient Near Eastern epic story. But I'd like to give you a little bit this morning of the background of this and then use that as a basis to do a comparison. That's not real visible, is it? And I'm afraid, I don't know if we want to, I wouldn't even know how to dim the lights. Can you kind of see that out there? I'm sorry, is that going to work okay? All right. So this document is called the Epic of Gilgamesh. It was one of those that was discovered along with, as we said last week, the Enuma Elish by Henry Austin Layard in the mid-1800s in the Great Library of Ashurbanipal. He didn't know what he was discovering, of course, as we said last week, but this was one of many different cuneiform documents that were unearthed at that time, and he took them more or less in fragmented form back to the British Museum, where for some years thereafter, there was an attempt to figure out, you know, what they meant and so on. The setting for this is the same as we saw last week. It is this fertile crescent, which is really the, I think, generally considered the first evidence we have in human history of true civilization. It takes place in Sumer. We gave you some of the background last week, and this entire region going up to the north following the Tigris and Euphrates and then coming back down along the eastern seaboard of the Mediterranean becomes that region where we find the first really ancient evidence of some kind of civilized community. The Tigris and Euphrates allowed for the development of irrigation. And at least it seems to me the best scholarly opinion is that that's the reason that we begin to see civilized communities emerging. Whereas people had been hunter-gatherers, you know, at least as near as we can tell in the very ancient world, the first attempt to work cooperatively, so you have communities cooperating with other communities, seems to have originated here because with limited rainfall, but with these two water courses, it occurred to somebody that it would be a great idea to just form canals, irrigation canals, but you don't do that on your own. You have to have cooperation. And so it seems that was the first attempt, at least that's been found, to try to build some kind of cooperative community in which various towns are sharing together the resources that were presented by these two rivers. This, of course, is the region that is part of present-day Iraq, as we were saying last week. A little better map than I had last week, but you'll notice the little pink area there is Sumer. It wasn't that big, but it seems to be the very earliest expression of civilized humanity, and then this larger region was the Akkadian dynasty, which came about 2400 BC, went for 200 or 300 years. And of course, Sargon I was the one, as we said last week, who really dominated that entire region. Well, we're interested more in Sumer, which is this tiny little area there in pink, because that's our original kind of exposure to this story of Gilgamesh. Gilgamesh is a famous guy. You've probably all heard of him, or at least heard the name, but the discoveries that were made in the ancient Near East, especially those in the mid-1800s, had all kinds of statuary, all sorts of reliefs and so on, that pictured him as one of the great heroic characters, maybe the first heroic character that comes to the surface from a pagan point of view in the ancient Near East. He appears to have been an actual character. He was the king, apparently, of Uruk, U-R-U-K, which is, by the way, is the same as the biblical Erech, E-R-E-C-H. He seems to have ruled there in Sumer about 2700 B.C. You notice in this particular sculpture, he is bigger than life. That's a full-grown lion that he's holding there. Looks like a good-sized, you know, sort of house cat, but he was understood as a famous hunter, and especially a lion killer. And so this is one of many statues that kind of celebrate that aspect of Gilgamesh's fame. And he was otherwise well known and as I say, kind of took on epic proportions. There have been some attempts from a biblical point of view to tie this guy Gilgamesh to the character in the Bible known as Nimrod. This has not been especially successful. There's been some attempts to do it, and I think the debate goes on. You know that Nimrod founded a city called Nimrud, and the location of that city is also a matter of history. It's been discovered and excavated and so on. It's possible that these two are the same, but I think the likelihood of that is still, at best, pretty questionable. The Epic of Gilgamesh comes to us on clay tablets written in cuneiform. We commented on this last week. I just add this comment that the way they did this was they had soft clay. They would sort of have this kind of texture that they could easily imprint little wedge-shaped letters onto it, and then they would bake the clay so that it would dry and become almost as, well, something like rock, you know, very, very hard. So that's why we have the wonderful luxury of having all of these pretty much intact coming down to us to this day. I wonder about our own civilization, you know. We have email, we have a little bit of paper, we're going paperless, we have DVDs and CDs, but those are passing. I think any civilization that finds us 2,000 or 3,000 years will assume we lived in grass huts with dirt floors because we left nothing for the legacy, but the Sumerians figured it out. And so they have these wonderful clay tablets that have survived the centuries, and therefore we have a pretty good insight not only into the epic literature, but even the day-to-day life. We have financial records. We have IRS records. I mean, it's all there, you know, and it's pretty amazing how these sort of insights into that culture have come down to us. Scholars were able to translate this cuneiform by comparing it with later languages that were gradually being understood. So in a kind of Rosetta Stone approach, stories that were in languages well known were compared to this unknown language. It's a very laborious process that went on for some extended period of time. And the cuneiform writing, of course, was completely foreign to the first people who looked at it, but gradually it succumbed to the investigations of these scholars, and we therefore have these wonderful opportunities to read the writings of these people who lived so long ago. The Epic of Gilgamesh assumes the religious outlook that we were discussing last week. The centerpiece of their religious expression was the ziggurat, which is a kind of structure. Probably the Tower of Babel was one of these. This is the same one I showed you last week, a different angle on it. This was built around 2100, but there's quite a few over there. And this is probably the best preserved in the city of Ur. It's a religious temple. Leonard Woolley, the 20th century archaeologist who did a lot of work most of his career in that region, said it was a structure that would rise like a mountain in the desert. And it was where the Sumerians worshipped their local gods. In the Epic of Gilgamesh, the city of Uruk had particular deities that were especially important to them. Some we've heard of. One is Anu, who is conceived of as the father of the gods, and also the sky god, kind of the original, more or less distant god. Ishtar plays a role in the Gilgamesh epic. She's the goddess of love and war. Not unrelated topics. And, of course, we mentioned last week the name Esther in the Old Testament is simply that same name, just with a little bit of a language spin to it. Then there's one more deity that shows up in the Epic of Gilgamesh called Lugabanda, who was an ancestor of Gilgamesh, maybe his father, more likely his grandfather, now being deified, is one that plays a role of protecting Gilgamesh and so on in his various adventures. The Epic of Gilgamesh has been called the greatest epic in history before Homer's Iliad. Homer wrote the Iliad about 750 in round numbers BC. The Epic of Gilgamesh was written more like 2500, a good, you know, more than 1,000 years earlier, more like 1500 years earlier. And for that long, it seems to have been the epic poem of human literary expression. It's quite a remarkable piece to read. It's easy reading, and it's kind of fun reading, really. And so I do recommend it to you if you have the time and interest to take a look at it. It's not that long. You can read it in an hour and a half or less, I would say. But anyway, it is this kind of epic poem of a great adventure. The flood account that's in it is the reason we're interested in it. The epic itself was discovered, the stone tablets, or the clay tablets, I should say, were found in 1849. They were hauled back to the British Museum. Many scholars spent a great deal of time over the years trying to fathom the content of these. And there was one particular scholar by the name of George Smith, who in 1872 stood up and read to the British Archaeological Society a paper that he had just completed in which he had translated one of the tablets associated with the Gilgamesh epic. And he announced at that point that he had found this remarkable description of a flood which bore striking similarity to the biblical account of the flood, and yet was obviously written well over a good 1,000 years before the flood account written by Moses was committed to writing. And that would, so the earliest we'd say Moses' writings would be around 1500. Here's something that goes back 1,000 years earlier. And it gives an account of a flood, which when we talk about it in a minute, I think you'll agree has some striking points in which they are corollary. That sent a shockwave around the world in 1872. And of course, as you can imagine, people everywhere, depending on their biblical disposition, went 1,000 different directions with this. So people sympathetic to the biblical message said, you see, this proves it. You know, there was a great flood, and the Epic of Gilgamesh is now confirming that. And so those people who wanted to see this as confirming the biblical message applied it that way. Biblical critics, on the other hand, of whom there were many, said, this proves that the Hebrews just borrowed that epic and warmed it over and kind of reworked it for their own purposes, and that there's nothing inspired about it. It's just the Hebrew spin on a Mesopotamian myth. So take your pick, you see. This is the way scholarship has been down through history, and I tell you that debate continues to this very day. But be that as it may, we'll just simply note it for its intrinsic interest here. It is not the only account of a flood. Since that time, of course, it's been discovered that there are many, many accounts of a great deluge. The Sumerian, the Mesopotamians, the Assyrians, the Babylonians, the Persians, and so on, even the Hittites, all of them have a kind of long distant memory of a great flood. Whether they all share a common source, whether they are independent memories of a great cataclysm, remains a wide open debate. But that there is some kind of collective consciousness in the ancient Near East of a great flood that occurred, you know, way back when, I think everybody grants, is just taken for granted these days. And so the Epic of Gilgamesh is simply one, probably the most famous, certainly the most complete account of such a deluge. Gilgamesh, who's the hero of this story, is presented to us as a guy who is one-third God and two-thirds man, which presents for him a dilemma. And it reminds me a little bit, the way Gilgamesh is portrayed in the story is a little bit the way Pascal describes the human tension. Pascal, you may know, Blaise Pascal, that wonderful French philosopher, Christian theologian, said that the dilemma of humanity, the tension of our humanity, he says, is that we're caught in this tension between what on the one hand is our grandeur and on the other hand our misery. He says we have the mind of an angel. We can think great thoughts, but we have the body of a beast. We're trapped in our own limitations, our own penchant for bloodshed and evil. And that becomes our dilemma. And in many ways, Gilgamesh captures that tension. And if you're looking for a psychology of the Epic of Gilgamesh, it really is this tension as it's presented between his kind of divine side and this humanness which continues to plague him. The principal themes, therefore, of the epic itself deal with issues of mortality, death. Gilgamesh, being mostly human, is certainly going to die. That disturbs him deeply. It becomes really the inspiration for the entire drama, you might say, of the epic as it unfolds. The story itself, I want to give you very briefly and then read a little bit of an excerpt from the epic that has to do with this flood. But the basic storyline, for those of you who are interested, is there is Gilgamesh. He is a great king. He's a powerful character, but he's a little bit full of himself. He's so dominating and really rude and somewhat brutal that the people over whom he rules finally begin to complain, and their complaints reach the ears of the gods. And so the gods decide to teach him a lesson. And to teach him a lesson, they create his equal, who is a character named Enkidu. I love that name, you know. If I ever again have a dog, Enkidu. So Enkidu comes along, and Enkidu is this kind of savage character, but equal in power and strength and prowess to Gilgamesh. And immediately, Gilgamesh is on the ropes, because now there's somebody that can stand up to him. And they have a huge battle, and they fight and claw and punch and all the things that, you know, you can imagine. And finally, as often happens, after they fought and fought and fought and worn themselves out, they become the best of friends. And so Enkidu and Gilgamesh are inseparable. And they have this lasting friendship, and that sends them on a great adventure. And so the next kind of chapter of this story is the forest adventure. This is really kind of like Lord of the Rings stuff. I don't know why somebody hasn't picked up on this as a made-for-movies kind of thing, because it would work. But they go on this great adventure. They meet all kinds of, you know, dragons and monsters, and they slay them and all this kind of stuff. I won't go into the detail. It's kind of a fun read. But anyway, the forest that they visit seems to be the forest of Lebanon. You've heard of the cedars of Lebanon. Well, that does seem to be where they go, and they engage in this adventure. And as a result of their successes, Ishtar, this goddess of war and love, takes an interest in Gilgamesh. That's part of her whole history, is seducing humans. And she sees now Gilgamesh as an attractive character. And so in a section that is borders on the R-rated, so I won't go into detail, but, you know, she begins to extend her solicitations to Gilgamesh. But he's a smart enough guy to know that in the wake of her solicitations are a whole string of destroyed lives. These guys have been taken in by her beauty and then destroyed by her in the process. And so Gilgamesh is smart enough to say, "Sorry, sweetie, no deal," you know. And that makes her very, very upset. And so she gets some of the other gods to join in pronouncing a judgment. And the judgment is that Enkidu is going to die, and he does. And that, for Gilgamesh, is a traumatic moment, because it brings thundering home to him the knowledge of mortality and his own mortality, and all of that becomes really the deep sort of psychological aspect of this epic, is Gilgamesh wrestling with his own mortality. And so as he concerns himself with this and ponders what it means and is really in a great kind of lament, he decides to go and try to find a strange character known as Utnapishtim, the Faraway. Utnapishtim, the Faraway, is by legend a guy who has been given immortality by the gods. And so Gilgamesh thinks, if that guy has found the secret to immortality, I want to go find him, and maybe I can get the secret as well. And so he starts off on the second great journey of this story, and it is concerning this character, Utnapishtim. Now, the backstory for Utnapishtim is this. He had lived for many, many years, and there had been in his history, can you believe it, honey? My phone is ringing. You know? She told me to turn off my phone. I say, oh, come on. Who's going to call in the middle of Sunday school, you know? So, well, there you are. I have learned a lesson in 27 years of marriage. Whenever my wife says anything, no matter how wrong she is, she's right. I mean, there ain't no winning a contest here. I don't know. So I just finally just give up. You know, took longer. Some of you guys figured that out a lot earlier. It's taken me a long time. Or later. That's right. So anyway, the backstory on Utnapishtim is he was, as the story goes, a character who had survived a great flood by building a boat and putting all of his family into it and preserving them there. And so, of course, Utnapishtim in this epic of Gilgamesh is clearly the counterpart to Noah in the story that we have recorded for us in the Bible. So Gilgamesh goes. Again, it's a kind of a rollicking adventure. He has to deal with a lot of challenges and so on, but eventually he does reach Utnapishtim, the faraway. We don't know where. There's no really way to tell geographically which direction he goes, but he finally gets to this guy who has, by the story's kind of storyline, been given this privilege, this gift of immortality. And Gilgamesh comes and asks him how it is that he's received the gift of immortality. And Utnapishtim, who's happy to have the company, decides to tell him the story. And the story is going to be a story that's recorded in one chapter. And this is the chapter that George Smith was able to finally translate and read in 1872. I'm not going to read the entire chapter to you, but I want to read a pretty good chunk of it. So I hope you'll bear with me. I know that being read to is not the most fun thing in the world, but I think you'll find this interesting. And then again, if you'd like to look at this in greater detail, then you certainly would, I think, find it interesting to do so. But this is chapter 5 of the Epic of Gilgamesh, and it's called The Story of the Flood. And in this story, Utnapishtim now is telling an account. And I want you to keep in mind that here is, these are clay tablets that date easily to 1,000 years earlier than the earliest date anybody would ever say the biblical account was written, which all by itself just makes it very interesting. Whatever we make of that, I mean, critics will go one direction, you know, lovers of the Bible may go a different, but just the very fact that we have this, I think in and of itself is fascinating to anybody interested at all in the whole deal. So, I'm going to read this, bear with me here as we go along, but this is Utnapishtim now responding to the question to Gilgamesh about how it was that he had acquired immortality. And so Utnapishtim begins. You know the story of Sherapak. Now Sherapak is a city in Sumer, and that's where Utnapishtim had lived. It stands on the banks of the Euphrates. That city grew old, and the gods that were in it were old. There was Anu, lord of the firmament, their father, and warrior Enlil, their counselor, Ninurta, the helper, Enugi, watcher over the canal. Some of these names we've heard before. And with them also was Ea. In those days, listen to this, the world teemed. The people multiplied. The world bellowed like a wild bull. And the great god was aroused by the clamor. Enlil heard the clamor, and he said to the gods in council, "The uproar of mankind is intolerable, and sleep is no longer possible by reason of the babel," B-A-B-E-L. So the gods agreed to exterminate mankind. Enlil did this, but Ea, because of his oath, warned me, Utnapishtim, in a dream. He whispered their words to my house of reeds. Utnapishtim lives in a reed house. Reed house, reed house, wall, O wall, hearken, reed house, wall, reflect, O man of Sherapuk, son of Ubaratutu, tear down your house and build a boat. Abandon possessions and look for life. Despise worldly goods and save your soul alive. Tear down your house and build a boat. These are the measurements of the bark as you shall build her. Let her beam equal her length. Let her deck be roof like the vault that covers the abyss. Then take into the boat the seed of all living creatures. When I understood this, I said to my Lord, "Behold, what you've commanded I will honor and perform. But how shall I answer the people, the city, the elders?" And so this launches into a little discussion because Utnapishtim is wondering, how am I going to explain this strange behavior to the people in this city? And in this case, he's told to develop a little subterfuge, telling the people in the city, God wants to bless you, but he's very unhappy with me. And so I'm building this boat so I can escape, because otherwise they're going to get me. This is, of course, exactly the opposite of the way Noah is presented biblically as a preacher of righteousness. But anyway, I'll skip by that. Then we have a description of how the boat itself was going to be built. I'm going to skip by that. So I want to pick up then a little bit later in the same story then. Then was the launching full of difficulty. There was a shifting of ballast above and below till two-thirds was submerged. I loaded into her all that I had of gold and of living things, my family, my kin, the beasts of the field, both wild and tame, and all the craftsmen. I sent them on board, for the time that Shamash had ordained was already fulfilled. When he said, in the evening, when the rider of the storm sends down the destroying rain into the boat, batten her down. The time was fulfilled. The evening came. The rider of the storm sent down the rain. I looked out at the weather. It was terrible. So I too boarded the boat, battened her down. All was now complete, the battening and the caulking. So I handed the tiller to Puzur Amuri, the steersman, and the navigation and care of the whole boat. So he gets into the boat with these animals, clean and unclean, and his family and so on. And now we have this description, and this is this description of the flood itself. When the first light of dawn, a black cloud came from the horizon. It thundered within where Adad, lord of the storm, was riding. In front over hill and plain, Shalut and Hanish, heralds of the storm, led on. Then the gods of the abyss rose up. Nergal pulled out the dams of the nether waters, water from below. Ninurta, the warlord, threw down the dikes, and the seven judges of hell, the Anaki, raised their torches, lighting the land with livid flame. A stupor of despair went up to heaven. When the god of the storm turned daylight to darkness, when he smashed the land like a cup, one whole day the tempest raged, gathering fury as it went. It poured over the people like the tides of battle. A man could not see his brother, nor the people be seen from heaven. Even the gods were terrified at the flood. They fled to the highest heaven, the firmament of Amnu. They crouched against the walls, cowering like curs. Then Ishtar, the sweet-voiced queen of heaven, cried out like a woman in travail, "Alas, the days of old are turned to dust because I commanded evil. Why did I command this evil in the council of all the gods? I commanded wars to destroy the people, but are they not my people? For I brought them forth now like the spawn of fish. They float in the ocean. The great gods of heaven and of hell wept. They covered their mouths." So here we have the flood, which terrifies even the gods and causes them this great sense of regret. All right, one more paragraph. You're doing this okay? Bearing with me here? All right. For 6 days and six nights, the winds blew, torrent and tempest and flood overwhelmed the world. Tempest and flood raged together like warring hosts. When the seventh day dawned, the storm from the south subsided. The sea grew calm, the flood was stilled. I looked at the face of the world and there was silence. All mankind was turned to clay. The surface of the sea stretched as flat as a rooftop. I opened a hatch and the light fell on my face. Then I bowed low, I sat down, I wept. The tears streamed down my face, for on every side was the waste of water. I looked for land in vain, but 14 leagues distant there appeared a mountain. And there the boat grounded on the mountain of Nisir. The boat held fast. She held fast and did not budge, which he then repeats about 8 times. So I'll drop down. When the seventh day dawned, I loosed a dove and let her go. She flew away, but finding no resting place, she returned. Then I loosed a swallow, and she flew away, but finding no resting place, she returned. I loosed a raven. She saw that the waters had retreated. She ate, she flew around, she cawed, she did not come back. Then I threw everything open to the four winds. I made a sacrifice and poured out a libation on the mountaintop. 7 and again 7 cauldrons I set up on their stands. I heaped up wood and cane and cedar and myrtle. When the gods smelled the sweet savor, they gathered like flies over the sacrifice. Remember, it's quid pro quo worship. Sacrifices feed the gods. Then at last Ishtar also came. She lifted her necklace with the jewels of heaven that once Anu had made to please her. O you gods here present, by the lapis lazuli around my neck, I shall remember these days as I remember the jewels of my throat. These last days I shall not forget. Let all the gods gather around the sacrifice, except Enlil. He shall not approach this offering, for without reflection he brought the flood. He consigned my people to destruction. And then the text goes on. So, any casual reader of that has to be impressed that there are these points where we have this kind of similarity between the two. You also have to be impressed, I think, with the fact that there are some conspicuous and obvious differences, aren't there? And so it is an interesting kind of parallel in which we have both those things which seem to be somewhat similar and yet some very striking and significant points of difference. The scholar who wrote the intro to this book, which is, by the way, a very fine treatment, I don't know that he's coming at all from a Christian perspective, but he summarizes at one point the considerable similarities but also differences between these two accounts. And I can't do better than just kind of summarize what he says here. But he says, he notes this first of all, in the biblical story, the same machinery is used. The building of the boat, the entry of the animals, the flood, the loosing of birds, the sacrifice. But while the God who remembered Noah, biblical account, lives in awful isolation, our scholar says, in the Assyrian, as in the Sumerian stories, we are still in the world of factious, flustered, and fallible deities. And that is the first great difference that we probably want to notice, is that while the Gilgamesh account gives us, at least in terms of the factual scenario, these striking similarities, notice the difference in the way the supernatural is portrayed to us. In the Gilgamesh epic, you've got these same gods who are at each other's throats. They're squabbling, they're factious, they're jealous, they're immoral, and so on. And there's a great, wonderful, holy dignity about the God of the Bible who brings this judgment to bear. He goes on and says, there's a real danger that the powers of chaos and destruction will get out of hand. Things do indeed go too far. The gods are shocked by the results of their own action, but nothing shows more strikingly the difference in outlook and purpose than the conclusion. In place of God's solemn pledge to Noah, while the earth remains, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, night and day shall not cease, he says, in contrast, there is the nauseating picture of God swarming like flies over the sacrifice. And that again becomes one of the most striking distinctions. Here on the one hand is God who is in perfect control of what's happening, not in any sense dependent on humanity, nor terrified or intimidated by the flood that has been unleashed. But in the Gilgamesh epic, these gods themselves are on the run at the uncontrolled powers that have been unleashed by their own hands. Instead of the rainbow pledge, God promising to Noah this continuity that would continue now, which we continue to enjoy, there is only Ishtar fingering her necklace and exclaiming that she will not forget these days. But this is the word of the most notoriously faithless of the gods. Here's Ishtar giving some little hint that, oh, this was so bad, we better not let this happen again. But who can trust her, you see? Whereas the great God, the holy God of Noah's experience, makes this solemn promise that even though there's been this catastrophe, from now on, like clockwork, this cosmology is going to operate and be something we can depend on. So too the immortality and semi-divine status which Utnapishtim win for themselves and their families is very different from the solemn covenant of the Bible between God and the still entirely human Noah. Noah's not given immortality. He's still a human being and treated that way in the biblical account, as you know. And so the Mesopotamian myth, he concludes, leaves the people in a state of anxiety, lest there be some catastrophe like this that would happen again. There's no sense that now they can rest securely on a kind of firm foundation of God's providential care of the universe. That's the way Gilgamesh leaves it. And immortality for Gilgamesh is simply the legacy that a man can leave for himself by building great monuments with his name all over them and then putting his grave somehow inside those monuments. But the biblical account leaves us with something so much more grand, so much more befitting the great dignity of God himself and the dignity that he gives to us, because there is this sense in which God now has accomplished his purpose and placed us in this situation of, at least within the created order, a kind of security. So again, as I'm kind of reaching a conclusion here, what do we learn from this? We learn that there is this striking correlation of a biblical account. This certainly doesn't prove necessarily that a deluge happened, but it is very interesting. We see that there's these striking similarities, but we also see that at the deepest level, these are two different stories. That one of the stories is simply the speculations of the human imagination trying to make sense out of a catastrophe, and at best coming up with ambiguous and unsatisfying solutions and answers. And on the other hand, we have divine revelation, which gives us the same great catastrophe, but we come out the other end of the tube in this one with this deep, deep sense that God is to be trusted, that God, even in the tumultuous storms of life, as bad as they may be, is the one who places us in an ark of protection, a guarded place, a place of security in the midst of what may be, you know, the chaos around us. And that motif runs through the scriptures, of God placing us in that ordered, protected kind of area and keeping us safe, overshadowing us, if you will, even in the midst of the catastrophes that may befall us.